When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds.
And Senator Mitch McConnell has joined Donald Trump and Carrie Lake by shying away from a national abortion ban. We have such a great show for you today. Nina Jankowicz stops by to tell us about her new organization, the American Sunlight Project, and how she is fighting disinformation. Then we'll talk to Bolts Magazine's Daniel Nakanian about state-level politics that can have a big impact on our future. But first, we have the host of The Enemies List, the Lincoln Project's own, Rick Wilson.
Rick Wilson!
Molly Jongfast! How are you?
I am in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, living the dream.
Nerd prom beckons!
It's right. But the only thing worse than being. So talk to me about, here we are. We are the Supreme Court. What did you think of that?
Look, I know a lot of people were like, oh, they seem to be ready to restrict Trump's immunity. They were also seemingly okay with Trump's attorney sitting there saying, well, you know, we could sort of assassinate people, maybe not everybody. But they were talking about the president having the right to engage in any kind of criminality inside the, quote, ambit of his office. I'm sorry, folks. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. And I was, I think, as disappointed as anybody that supposed conservatives on the court, who are not, by the way, conservatives anymore, they're radical and they're far, far, far outside of the traditional definition of conservatism, were essentially on the present case, they're sort of lollygagging and bullshitting along. Whatever.
Right.
You know, we'll get to it when we get to it, I guess. I'm talking about the future. And also really describing an openness. You know, when they're saying things like the president must be able to take bold and effective action. And when they're describing it that way, all I can think of is, oh, God, these little weasels are going to say, oh, well, martial law is not bad. You know, I mean, not bad per se.
Right. Who among us?
Who among us has not wanted to declare martial law? The entire thing had a terrible feel to it. I'm not an attorney, as I have famously noted about a billion times, but I kept coming back to this thing that I do know about, and that's people. And the thing that I do know about, and that's politics. And I'm telling you, the argument they were making was, well, unless we give the president's immunity, they'll all transform into criminals.
Yeah.
Where the real worry that I think anybody who knows anything about human beings is, if they don't have any restrictions, they will turn into criminals. This is what laws are for. And the idea that you have to protect the president in such a massively sweeping, expansive way. I had a lot of trouble yesterday with a lot of my friends on the right and the center right and the left who say things like, "Oh, don't worry, Trump will be restrained by the rule of law and the institutions in Washington." I'm like, where? Which ones? Just show me. Show me on the doll where the institutional protections are, because I don't see it. Show me where you think that Trump won't do the worst possible things, because I don't see it.
One of the things that I was so struck by was that what this Supreme Court is saying, so it sounds like they're probably going to kick it back to the district court and give Trump the delay he wants. Mm-hmm. But what I was so struck by is like what you have to realize about this is the institution not holding. Right. Correct. That's what this is.
Correct. This is everything falling apart.
Right. This is the three Trumpy justices going along to get along in a way that serves their guy.
Yeah. And for all of the idea that Amy Comey Barrett was the one Republican yesterday
who at least asked questions,
right, sort of kind of even giving a shit about the question of whether or not there were restrictions and limits. If Amy Comey Barrett is your like rock star in this thing and John Roberts, the one that the supposed normie, I'm sorry. This is a bad spot to be at this point. This is not great.
I would say it is not great. You just have to realize that these are the institutions not holding, and that no one is going to save
no
the
one's
American
coming
people
to save
but
themselves.
You.
Nope. We have to vote him out. We have to vote out his minions in a scope and scale and degree that, to use a Trumpian metaphor, has never been seen before. You know, you have to beat the hell out of him. You have to beat the hell out of him. You have to destroy them in political terms.
Right. Yes. Important that you specify.
Yeah. These days, I have to say politically, I'll get in trouble otherwise. We saw the court make a very political, the vibe space of that court was extremely political. And the nodding and the winking and the sort of snideness from Alito about, well, we know prosecutors are crooked. Oh, really?
Can I just say one thing about that? If Alito were a liberal and there were two insane liberal justices on the court, let's just play this out for a minute.
Okay.
It's a thought experiment as much as anything.
A Gedunken experiment. Yes.
Right. If there were two insane liberals on the court, you don't think the Republicans in the Senate would make their lives a misery? Like,
of course
Democrats,
they would.
You control the Senate. You know what Sheldon Whitehouse could do if Chuck Schumer would let him. And let him. Let Sheldon Whitehouse have hearings every day. And if Justice Thomas doesn't want to come, fine. But let the American people know that these people are not, you know, that they're not on the level.
You know, I just wish yesterday that Ketanji Brown Jackson had recused herself, given that her husband was so involved in planning the 1/6 attack. And I'm sorry. That wasn't Ketanji Brown Jackson. That was Clarence Thomas. But the idea that we have a sense of inevitability about the court letting Trump go, letting him off, because they know very well if he doesn't get prosecuted now, it's not going to happen in time for the election. They get it. They're perfectly aware of it. And if we don't end up, and I think pretty quickly, following the Wilson rule from about a year and a half ago, where I kept telling people, nothing is going to change in the courts that's going to save you. Stop thinking that way.
You do have to admit that you are like a little bit impressed with how good the New York case has turned out.
Listen, I will tell you flat out, I thought that case was the weakest. And it turns out they built a pretty solid case here. And the reason I know it's a pretty solid case is that Donald Trump has kept his goddamn mouth shut about David Pecker.
Yeah, it's amazing.
He's not trying to go out there and cause the Trumpian mob to go after David Pecker. He knows there is evidence being put out there that for most Americans feels new. They either forgot it or they didn't know it or it was too on the margins in 2016. But now they're like, porn star? What? They admitted it? I think, look, it's still not the full game changer for the entire election.
Right, but nothing is.
But right.
Because the institutions did not hold.
No, it doesn't hurt to see Sleepy Don there every day in his diaper, snoozing and grumpy.
And I would also add that What I think is very interesting about this case is, again, the pundit industrial complex said this is the weakest case. This is the case. I wouldn't want this case to go first. It's terrible. And the theory of the case basically was that Michael Cohen was a bad witness. Meanwhile, Michael Cohen hasn't even been up there. In fact, we have David Pecker, who turns out to be an incredible witness.
Don't you think? I mean, don't you think he's been kind of shockingly great for the prosecution?
I mean, he signed a non-prosecution agreement, so they knew exactly what he was going to say because he didn't want to go to jail.
It's not the worst incentive.
No. And, you know, in this case, I think it's smart. And what I think is really interesting is he talks about, I mean, there are, you know, he says this wasn't about Melania. It was about the election. He said that he went to his general counsel and his general counsel said you shouldn't pay off Stormy Daniels because it'll look like an election interference. And it'll be, we don't know what he said to a special counsel because that's confidentiality, but clearly something that got him not to pay Stormy Daniels. So, and the likely had election, you know, that he knew what he was doing was illegal.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
He is making the entire case right there.
I do think that Pecker has been, I mean, aside from all the puns that I've been able to make for the last several days, I do think that Pecker has been remarkably compelling in validating the things that they're going to ask Michael Cohen about in a few days. Trump's going to say, oh, Cohen's a liar. He's an adjudicated liar. You know, just like Trump is an adjudicated rapist. Sorry, I just had to mention that.
A judge has ruled he's a racist.
Yes.
But yes, a jury, I don't think of.
But long story short, all this testimony from Pecker is going to validate a lot of the things that Michael Cohen, who has cooperated extensively, is going to say in the course of the next few days. And I think people have undercounted what Michael will have to say that could be seem less credible because of the attack the Trump folks are going to bring in on the fact that Michael went to prison for lying on Trump's behalf. But David has come across and basically said, okay, you know what? I did these things for him. I was doing him a favor. I was helping him because of the campaign. Michael's going to say it's because of the campaign. We now end up knowing that, you know, Trump also was talking to Hope Hicks and Sarah Hucklefuck, and that they knew it was about political motivation. The whole thing is just not going for Trump as smoothly as I think he might have hoped.
I want to talk about Sarah Huckabee and Hope Hicks because they did this while working in the White House. So your tax dollars.
Yeah, let's not forget they were White House government paid staffers.
I mean, just insanity, like the government paid those people to help Donald Trump cover up his affair with an adult film star. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
I will die on the hill of the fact that this guy is a degenerate and that he has no moral sense whatsoever. But he had enough political sense to understand that the exposure of payoffs to Stormy Daniels was not bueno when it came to the political effect it would have on his campaign, on his prospects of being elected president. And because of that consciousness of the damage it could do, that's where we're at right now. That's where the situation, to my mind, is the most interesting because he knew what was going to happen if it got out there further. He understood it. Trump is not a smart man, but he has a feral cunning and a craftiness about him. And he picked it up. He read the room. And in doing so, that's sort of how he's put himself in this terrible box. Do you pretend that this was nothing? Do you deny it again and get banged for perjury? The whole thing's just really ugly for him. And I'm here for it.
What do you think would have happened had the Stormy Daniels came forward before the election? Like, what if the weekend of that excess Hollywood tape that had also burst?
I do think it would have been a thing. It would have caused a ruckus. Now, I don't know. I can't say that some of the things Hillary should have been doing, being in Wisconsin, et cetera, I can't say that would have cost him the race completely. But it would have made it much more problematic. It would have changed the news cycle at the end there a bit. The presumption was that it had already killed him.
Right.
And that's a presumption that people cannot afford to make again. Although I will say this, there's a lot of polling theory starting to come out now. And the way to move these voters is not as much like, oh, we're going to find other Republicans to say how a bad Republican he is or any of that. It is increasingly that voters need to be presented with new information. And when they find that this new information, or if it feels new, okay,
and then
they are much more likely to go, hold up, what am I doing here? Wait a second, what am I doing here? And so Stormy kind of feels new to a lot of people. She was not somebody who has been in the news flow every single minute of every single day since Trump left office. Now that she is, it's not great for him.
Yeah, it does seem as if these salacious characters coming back from 2015, I mean, this is like 7 years ago.
Like I said, it feels new to most people. Look, there's a generation of young voters who are now like, who the fuck is that? What are you talking about?
I mean, do you think there's a generation of young voters, or
there's a cohort of younger voters? And you see this in some of the polling, like the younger voters are like, oh, I guess Trump was pretty good economically.
Right.
And it's because they weren't really fully politically conscious at that time. But man, I mean, this is a place where we really have, you know, Trump in misery because he's trapped in a courtroom listening to this shit. He's trapped in a courtroom every day having to listen to this get recapitulated. And look, whatever, I mean, all kidding aside, whatever they pay Melania to keep quiet, in the end, it's not enough because, you know, she's got to sit there and eat this shit sandwich every day. She's got to sit there and eat this gigantic shit sandwich.
One of the big anxieties, I think, that we're seeing a lot of Democrats, people listen to this podcast and people who we, you know, come into contact with, is like, are voters moved? Like, can voters connect with some of the information that's out there? I mean, for example, like Biden World, they passed this humongous aid package,
right,
which no one thought they were going to be able to do, including me. I was like, there's no way they're getting money. And they got this money. They got Mike Johnson to do it. I mean, that was shocking to me. I thought it was over for Ukraine. And they really disappointed one Vladimir Putin. I mean, I think it was tough for him.
Putin had a bad day. There's no way to spin your way out of that one. You can't spin your way out of the fact that a guy you thought was in your pocket turned around and absolutely wrecked your shit. And I'm here for it. I think that there is a degree to which the Biden administration and the Biden campaign are going to continue to face this sort of weird cross pressure that they can do the right thing. They can do the right strategic things. They can do the right political and policy things. And yet people who should be with them are still like, not good enough. Fuck you. Not good enough. Give me more. Do better. I want something different.
Is that a post-pandemic syndrome? What do you think it is?
I don't know, Molly. We're going to probably disagree on this a little bit. I think there are some progressives who are exceedingly grumpy about certain things and won't stop being grumpy, even though it's hurting the team.
Yeah, but that's not a huge group. I mean, AOC's out there campaigning with him.
No. I'm not just talking about the legislative stuff. I'm talking about the protesters at universities.
Again, I hate polls, but like they say 2% of all young people care about that.
Yeah, I know. But guess what? 100% of Rupert Murdoch's audience sees those kids every night.
Right. But those are not liberals.
But I'm saying there are people broadly on the left who are like, yay, those kids are speaking the truth to power and blah, blah, blah. Don't be sentimental about this stuff, people. It's not a good look because every night on Fox now, the audience is being told the radicals are coming to kill you. Look, it's Antifa 2024. And that shit is not inconsiderable with working class Democratic voters. Do not undercount it. I spend a lot of time worrying about that.
Rick Wilson, I hope you'll come back.
You know I will. I'm your Huckleberry.
When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. Vanta automates compliance for ISO 27001 SOC 2 and more, saving you time and money. Unify your security program management and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, FlowHealth, and Quora use Vanta to build trust and improve security in real time. Access Vanta's free suite of resources to scale your governance, risk, and compliance program at vanta.com/special. That's VANTA.com/special.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Spring is here, and I bet you are trying to look fashionable. So why not pick up some fashionable, all-new Fast Politics merchandise? We just opened a new store with all-new designs just for you. Get t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and tote bags. To grab some, head to fastpolitics.com.
Nina Jankowicz is the founder of the American Sunlight Project and a former Department of Homeland Security official.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Nina.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
I feel like I need you to tell your origin story for our listeners.
Oh my God.
First, I'm sorry, but I could tell your origin story, but that doesn't solve anyone's problems. I always feel like it's better to have people tell them. So to have the guest explain it.
I'll try to tell you the short version, because otherwise we'll be here all day. I became a disinformation researcher a little bit by accident. I used to work in the democracy promotion space for the National Democratic Institute, which is a nonpartisan an organization that kind of does democracy promotion abroad. And I was a Russia specialist. That's where I cut my teeth. I did work in the former Soviet space. And around 2013, when the Euromaidan protests happened, like the first invasion of Ukraine, that's when I started noticing, hey, like Russia's doing some scary shit with the internet and we all need to wake up to it. And I was told a lot here in Washington, like, oh, no, like everything's fine. You know, that's happening over there in those countries, but we don't need to worry about it here. Fast forward a couple of years, we all know what happened with Russian interference in 2016 and 2017. I actually happened to be in Kyiv at the time. I was a advisor to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs under a Fulbright grant that year. And so watching all of that happen from abroad, particularly from Ukraine, which had been living the realities of Russian disinformation for so long, really frustrated me. And I wrote a book about how to lose the information war. That was my first book. And then I did a lot more research on disinformation, not just of the Russian variety, over the next couple of years. Fast forward to 2022, I get a call from the Biden administration asking me if I'd like to come serve my country, help advise the Department of Homeland Security on the disinformation problem, and kind of craft disinformation policy that made sure it had respect for civil rights, civil liberties, and privacy. And of course, I said yes, right? Like I had always been working toward public service, and I thought that this was an urgent issue that our government needed to solve. One of the first things I said to my bosses at DHS when I got there was like, we need to announce this and we need to do it soon because I'm a public figure and people are wondering where I've gone. At the time, it was like right after the second invasion of Ukraine began. And so I suddenly disappeared from media as a Ukraine expert, which was suspicious. And they dawdled for like 8 weeks. And then they finally announced it in a very opaque way. And the right wing went absolutely nuts. And actually some on the far left as well. They claimed that my job leading the Disinformation Governance Board, which admittedly is a very bad name that I did not come up with. They said that I was going to be like America's chief censor. Tucker Carlson said that I had the power to send men with guns to the homes of Americans with whom I disagree. And people were accusing me of treason. At the time, Molly, I was 37 weeks pregnant and people were sending me and my family death threats. We were doxxed. It was a really, really nasty situation that unfortunately has become very normal in our politics today. And the administration did not have my back. They let me twist in the wind. I think there were other political priorities at the time, but it became clear to me that they weren't going to solve this issue. Not just like my personal part in the issue, but they weren't going to put their back into like a really muscular response to disinformation. And just to be clear, the board had nothing to do with censorship. It was a coordination and policy body. It didn't have the resources or frankly, the go-ahead from any part of government to do any sort of censoring or arbitering of truth. And I wouldn't have approved of that anyway. All of my research says that stuff doesn't work. But that didn't matter to the people who were lying about me for power and for profit. And so I resigned 3 weeks later. I had my baby. He's now almost two. And as I have like gone through the past 2 years, I realized I was the vanguard in this mostly conservative operation to really intimidate and harass disinformation researchers ahead of the 2024 election. And the idea, of course, is to do this for political gain. They have been hauling people before Congress. They have been suing them in frivolous lawsuits. Right.
They want them not to talk.
Exactly. And frankly, they're succeeding. Like these are the canaries in the coal mine, and those canaries are kind of getting snuffed out. Their funding has been endangered. Their families have been endangered. They're scared. Their institutions also don't have their backs in some cases, similar to what I've gone through. And here we are in a situation where we've got AI supercharging disinformation. We have foreign actors who are just licking their lips at the polarization and problems that they see in our American politics because it gives them so much to work with. And we've got people who are happily spreading disinformation for profit. And we haven't dealt with that at all. And social media platforms that have dropped the ball when it comes to not only disinformation, but like other online harms, because they're worried about the political backlash if Trump should get into office. So we have a cocktail of a really potentially explosive situation come November to January. And I decided to put up my hand and say, we need to do something about this because the worst has already happened to me, you know, safe from like physical altercation, which I hope, of course, doesn't happen. But like, I've gone through the shit. I'm tired of people harassing researchers under the guise of free speech. So yeah, that's the short version of me.
What do we think happened? I mean, I understand that you were sort of targeted by the disinformation you were trying to stop, right? I mean, isn't that the story ultimately?
Yeah.
And has that kept going with other people?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kept going with other people and still is happening to me. I mean, even before we announced our new project, the American Sunlight Project, I still get death threats regularly. I still get harassed regularly. It was to the point where like Fox News was defaming me so much, I decided to sue them because it was just ridiculous. They were mentioning me 8 months after I resigned from government and I would get a wave of harassment.
And did it work?
Well, we're waiting. Do you mean their defamation or my lawsuit?
Your lawsuit. Their defamation obviously worked, right?
Yeah. Their defamation is extremely effective. The lawsuit we're waiting to see. We're waiting for a judge to rule on the motion to dismiss, and then we'll see where we go from there. But I was the vanguard, right? And they came after researchers who did critical work around the election in 2020. People who were looking at things like COVID disinformation, people who were looking at things like child sexual abuse material. Right. We should all be able to get behind that. But no, they have now rebranded anybody who does information integrity research as somebody who is pro-censorship, which is just not the definition of censorship, but it's so good for them, right? Nobody wants to be in favor of censorship. And so they're able to kind of context collapse and make this argument. And it's so politically beneficial for them because they've effectively silenced the people who were calling out their BS for many years.
Yeah.
So what happens? This sounds bad for November.
I'm not particularly optimistic, especially because we've got AI in the mix. There was just a new report out today that said that despite OpenAI's promises about, you know, lobbying and electioneering and, you know, making sure that nobody uses their technology to create chatbots that can do that, OpenAI can be used to target Latino voters with misleading information. We know that population is extremely susceptible to it. We're more polarized than ever, right? And we've got these foreign actors that are all too happy to prey on that polarization. And so that's where we hope the American Sunlight Project can at least bring these issues to the forefront, if not try to solve them.
Explain to me what the American Sunlight Project is.
Yeah, so we are an organization, a bipartisan organization that is going to be attempting to increase the cost of lies that undermine our democracy. We're going to do that through research. We've got old school Oppo researchers on our team, and we've got some open source investigators as well, more from kind of the disinformation side of the spectrum. And we're going to be blowing open every link in the causal chain of disinformation, how it spreads, how it's financed, how it makes its way from Congress to Elon Musk to people like Stephen Miller at American First Legal, who then, you know, create these lawsuits, right? So we're going to first focus on the campaign against disinformation researchers, and then we're going to look at all of the other disinformation that will come between now and November. And there's going to be a lot. There's already been a ton since the beginning of the year. We're going to blow all that open. We're going to do, you know, advocacy work, talking to the American people. I think a lot of folks would be really scared to find out that we have modern day McCarthyism happening right now in America.
So you have to say more about that. What does that mean?
Oh,
yeah. My grandfather was put in jail by McCarthy. So this is not something I take lightly. So tell me what that means.
Yeah. I mean, so we've got the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, the subcommittee on weaponization of government led by Jim Jordan, who has sent out dozens of letters and subpoenaed researchers, including me. I had to go sit there for 5 hours and speak to some of those folks about my 11 weeks in government, with the implication that somehow I'm in cahoots and all these other researchers are in cahoots with social media platforms to censor conservatives. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. That's been borne out by evidence, which, again, we'll be collecting on our website so anybody can look at it. But the idea here is, OK, Congress is after you. If you're in an academic institution and your institution's having to spend hundreds of thousands, if not upwards of $1 million, defending you, getting you legal representation, responding to document requests, like, you don't have time to do your work anymore. You don't have time to do that research.
Right. And they don't have people to protect them.
100%. And so we want to make that case to the American people, but also tell people, you know, disinformation is not just some technical thing. It's not just mean words or words you disagree with online. It has effects on people's lives, normal Americans' lives. And so we're going to be telling those stories as well.
You're basically, it sounds like a little bit like Media Matters, but sort of with more of an emphasis on how the information gets there. Is that right? Or
yeah, I would say we're kind of a Media Matters for the disinformation age, the digital disinformation age, right? I want to put an emphasis on transparency and accessibility of this research. You know, we are a C4. We're keeping a close hold on our donors because this is a really dangerous environment right now, as I know personally. But our investigations are all going to be open source, all going to be transparent. People can recreate them themselves if they like and follow kind of the trail. And I think that's really important in these days of kind of where people are making these allegations based on, again, context collapse, no nuance, a total kind of just illusions that they're involved in our politics on. So that's really important to me. Not that Media Matters doesn't do that. They do great work. But
No. I mean, I'm just thinking of something that's like it.
Yeah, I think, and we consider Media Matters and folks like the Center for Countering Digital Hate and others in this ecosystem are allies in this fight, 100%.
I'm hoping you could explain what the sea change is at X and how different it is. Obviously, I'm asking you a question you know the answer to, but I mean that we all know the answer to, but I'm wondering if you could just expand on it.
Yeah, it's been such a sad thing to see X, formerly Twitter, kind of crumble into being this, you know, fringe hellhole, honestly, because it used to be a place where you could have conversations and get good information and follow topics that were important to you and also find community. And I think that's a really important one that's been blown open since Elon Musk took it over. I had never had a great experience on Twitter, now X. Like, I had always had a lot of abuse and nasty content coming at me there because I'm a woman who deigned to open my mouth on the internet. But it got measurably worse since Elon Musk took over. He fired most of the trust and safety staff. He fired people who were looking at human rights abuses around the world and making sure that the platform was safe for dissidents and opposition figures around the world. And he's incentivized the sort of outrageous behavior that was always, again, on the fringes. Now that's the stuff that people get paid for on the platform. And I've just kind of returned to Twitter to poke the bear in some ways, to kind of talk about what we're doing and show that, you know, it's still a problem. And I'm shocked at how bad the platform is now. And there have been a lot of studies, including by CCDH, who famously Musk tried to sue and got his wrist slapped. Actually, wrist slapped is, I think, a little too nice for what happened to him in court.
He tried to sue them, and he also tried to sue Media Matters, right?
Yeah, exactly. And he, to my knowledge, did not prevail in either case. And in the CCD, really got his ass kicked. And rightly so, right? Like, these are researchers looking at the harmful effects of this platform online. And he's tried to make it into a monetized hate parade. And that's sad. However, I will say it's nice to have a little bit more diversity in the social media space, like a lot of other places, to try out these messages, places that are a little bit more civil. But these communities have broken up as a result of Twitter breaking up, right? So like now it's, I would say it's not too far off from Truth Social or some of the other kind of quote unquote free speech platforms. Of course, it's only free speech for people that Elon likes. If you try to be critical of him, you get blocked or kicked off.
Can we talk about where everybody else is? Where is everyone else? Because like, they're certainly not on Twitter anymore. As someone who's stayed on Twitter, I feel like I'm by myself a lot of the time.
It feels like a giant echo, like you put something out. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think some people have gone to Threads, which I think, you know, has potential, but isn't really
very hard to use. I say this as someone who doesn't have that much trouble using stuff. I have a lot of trouble using that.
Yeah. And it also doesn't have DMs, which for journalists, for, you know, people who are doing work like the work we're doing, I mean, it's a feature that's really missing. But I will say it's the more civil of kind of the alternative platforms. A lot of people are on Blue Sky. A lot of the very far left leaning folks are on Blue Sky. It's a bit weird on there. I've been on there a little bit, but I don't think they have the user stats that Threads does. And then there's a lot of people, especially in kind of the public intellectual side of things, really trying hard to make Instagram and TikTok work for them. And it's just a really difficult transition to make. And I'm struggling with it too, right? Like going from text-based platform that you fire off while you're standing in your kitchen dealing with your snotty toddler to needing to make a fairly well-produced video. Like, I'm not a video producer, right? And it takes me a while. So I think we've really not regrouped yet. There's hope that like little personal communities like what Substack offers or other newsletters offer can be a nicer, kinder, gentler internet. But then, of course, we had the whole Nazi scandal at Substack. So I'm not sure. I think we're still figuring that out.
Yeah, it's true. The far right, are they somewhere where we don't know where they are, or are they still on Twitter?
I think a lot of them are still on Twitter. Obviously, Musk reinstated a lot of the accounts that had been banned or had strikes against them earlier on. So from what I've seen, there's plenty of far right gathering on Twitter. But there's also always been a kind of underground sort of social media layer for fringe groups, not only in things like, you know, the 4chans and 8kun's of the world. There's, you know, patriots.win. There's one particular forum that I tend to appear on a lot that is for owners of AR-15s, right?
Jesus.
So like there's all these little places and they're quite violent and nasty.
Yeah, that's not where you want to be.
No, that one's, whenever I get a notification about that, I'm pretty worried. But there's also kind of groups and Telegram channels and WhatsApp groups. And this is something I've been warning about for a couple of years, even before Twitter was imploding. And it's that we are driving people inadvertently into these closed groups and closed areas on the internet where it is hard to understand what they're doing, where it is hard to monitor that stuff. And don't get me wrong, I believe everybody should have places for private communication. But because of this, I hate using this term, but balkanization of the internet, it's making it a lot harder for not only researchers like me, but law enforcement to respond to this stuff. And I think that's part of the reason, you know, the January 6th response was not good enough, because we weren't really following to the extent that we needed to the conversation online. I mean, researchers were, but the government certainly is not up on the latest and greatest monitoring technology of this stuff, and certainly doesn't know like the ebbs and flows of where these folks are congregating. So we see some of them on Twitter, but I think there's a lot of the most worrisome rhetoric is on other places on the internet where it's a little bit more difficult to follow it.
Yeah. So interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Nakanian is the editor-in-chief and founder of Bolts Magazine.
Daniel, welcome to Fast Politics.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's so much interesting stuff going on, and every day I want to talk to you about what's happening at the state level. So Arizona is a swing state with a bunch of some real lunatic Republicans still in office. That's what I know at the federal level, right? Like people like Paul Gosar, like real wackadoos. So I can only imagine, these are the people who put in place the 1860 abortion law, right? So I can only imagine what's happening at the more granular state level. So continue.
Well, it's interesting in Arizona because it's the state that is extraordinarily important for presidential politics, for federal politics, for the U.S. Senate, for the White House. The more you go down, it's like a nested doll situation where the more you go local, state, you find more and more very important races that are stacking up together. I mean, arguably the most important electoral state this fall in that sense. And the abortion ban that you were just mentioning, the 1864 law that was just revived 2 weeks ago now by the state Supreme Court, has just dramatized that altogether. It's really brought tension around the judge races, these referendums, the races for the state assembly, the state senate, as well as races for prosecutor, which is what I just wrote about a few days ago, because I was interested in the people who actually would have authority to enforce the 1864 ban and potentially try and bring criminal charges against medical providers in the state. What are their thoughts? Are they going to enforce this? And even there are huge contrast between prosecutors. Just to give you one example, Molly, of the extreme on the right, there's one county attorney there, which is the title for prosecutors, who has been part of this lawsuit to try and revive the law. And when I reached out to their office to ask whether they would prosecute individuals or doctors or women under the law, they referred me for my questions to Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a religious nonprofit that is involved in all of these litigation around the country against abortion. They referred me to ADF for questions about whether they would prosecute people.
What?
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
That's a prosecutor's office in Arizona that is refusing to take questions from the media about their policy would be about whether medical providers in the county should be concerned, and instead is asking me to ask the same question to a religious organization. It's a pretty extreme situation. A lot of prosecutors are trying to dodge the question, which also is a problem, right? Like this is a simple question. What is your approach going to be to this new law that is now potentially in your hands? And some prosecutors are saying, nope, we will never use this law to charge anyone in the state of Arizona.
Right, which is a crazy place to be with the law. Like, I think that what's really important about this is it's good that they're not going to prosecute people for this because it's insane. But it's more important to realize, like, this is because the Republicans in the judiciary in Arizona and in the state house in Arizona are out of their fucking minds, right? The decision not to prosecute is because they have to do it because this law is so insane. Now, supposedly they did just pass a repeal, right? That they're going to go to the 15 weeks.
The state house has passed it. At this moment, the state senate hasn't yet. And so we'll see what happens. You're right. Even if that 1864 ban is repealed, other restrictions would still be in place, which also have criminal penalties in them. And so the same sort of question, who's going to enforce how? I mean, there's just so many pieces of that puzzle. So the extent to which this has just put all of those decisions at the hand of these very, very county-based officials is very extreme. Yeah.
Yeah. What does the election look like there? Who's up and how and where and discuss?
Yeah, pretty much everyone is up in Arizona. Just as I said with the prosecutors, what I was finding in my reporting is that the biggest Arizona county, Maricopa County, which is more than 4 million people, it's where Phoenix is, has a prosecutor race with a Democrat who says she will never file charges on abortion cases, and a Republican named Rachel Mitchell, who actually some of you may remember seeing on your TV, because in 2018, during the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, she was the person who Republicans tapped to interrogate Kristen Ford. She was at the time not yet the county attorney. She is now. She's running for re-election, and she's not answering questions on what she would do under the law. But then, you know, it goes all the way. There's all the races for state Senate and the state House are up. And if there is going to ever be a repeal of all of these abortion restrictions, it might have to go through the state and House and Senate. There also might be a referendum on a ballot that is still not final, but organizers are trying to put a referendum on a ballot to codify abortion rights. Now, we have seen referendums like that succeed, right? In Ohio last year, in many other states. So that would obviously be the defining election, I think, in November in Maricopa.
When do we know if the abortion referendum will make it on the ballot?
We will know that in coming months. The organizers have already succeeded at collecting the required number of signatures, but my understanding is that they want to continue collecting them just to make sure there's no surprises. But Molly, what's also super important is that there's always lawsuits around amendments initiatives in Arizona, and they often go to the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court has struck down referendums in the past as not relevant. And the state Supreme Court obviously is the same state Supreme Court that just revived the 1864 ban. And what's super important, two of the judges on the state Supreme Court are also on the ballot in November. They both actually voted to revive the 1864 ban, and they will both be in the ballot in November. Now, a final note, which is maybe the single craziest part, Republicans are also trying to pass a measure right now that would end elections for judges in Arizona and would apply to this year. So they're also trying to pass that right now.
So they want to be kings, right? I mean, that's the thinking here.
That measure would also be put on the ballot if Republicans succeed. And it would be such an intense election with not just abortion, but also the re-election of people who revived the abortion ban, and also this measure to end elections. It's really a state to watch throughout the year.
I mean, it's more than a state to watch. I mean, it's an example of the Republicans' anti-democratic leanings, right?
To that point, there's a lot of other measures Republicans have already put on the ballot to limit voting rights in the state of Arizona and to make it harder for people to put ballot initiatives and qualify them. That is already on the ballot. So there's already these measures to restrict elections, restrict voting rights that are already being pushed through in Arizona right now. And it's all coming to a head. We have seen it in other states like in North Carolina and Wisconsin, how hard it can be for measures like that to be recovered from. It can take a very long time for the conditions to be right for some of that stuff to be rolled back.
So voters really need to focus, right?
I mean, there's going to be a lot on their ballots. I mean, I just named four or five referendums that are going to be on their ballot, including potentially abortion, including voting rights. There's going to be so many local offices, some of which, you know, the stakes are hard, right? Like when you see a prosecutor race as one of the 20 elections to vote for, or a judge race, you might not necessarily know who these people are. There isn't even a party that is going to be on the ballot on the judge elections. You won't necessarily know that these are the people who voted to revive the abortion ban. So there's just a lot of research to be done on any election by voters to get to the stakes.
Talk to me about what other states you're watching and what other stuff is happening besides Arizona, which now has given me an anxiety attack.
Maybe let's talk about state courts for a moment, because obviously Arizona is responsible. The court is responsible for the ban, and then it's itself on the ballot. But that is also true in many states. You know, if at the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court is not up for election, but at the state level, in most states it is, and we're seeing the majority of states have elections this year for their court. Often these are the most tricky elections to figure out, because a judge's record is not heavily reported. It's hard to piece together. So at Bolts, I did a guide to every state's court races, there's very important stakes in so many. So I will start with naming Ohio and Michigan as the two states where a partisan majority could flip. And that has very high implications if it does for issues like abortion, issues like voting rights. It matters so much whether the majority on the court is Republican or Democratic. So in Ohio, Democrats have a shot at flipping the court. And in Michigan, Republicans are hoping to flip the court. Even beyond that, if you're in North Carolina, if you're in Mississippi, there's all these interesting judge elections that could shape the balance of power. And in fact, I'll end on Florida to say that just as in Arizona, there are two Supreme Court justices in Arizona who voted to ban abortion who are now on the ballot, the same is true in Florida. There are two justices who in March voted to uphold the abortion ban who are now going to be also up for a retention election in November. So you know, the stakes are actually quite similar. Abortion voting rights are coming up everywhere. And they're going to be under the radar of the presidential election, but they might also shape the presidential election because these are the people who will be called on to issue decisions in November and December if Trump tries to contest an election, for instance.
Tell me what else.
To take what I was saying about Arizona elsewhere, there's going to be abortion referendums in a lot of places. Again, the most important probably is going to be Florida because of the conditions there and the abortion ban that is going into place. There's also a referendum in November to lift the abortion ban. Now the issue in Florida for abortion rights proponents who almost always win at the ballot box, right? This is not a controversial issue.
It's a 60% right, threshold.
There's a threshold of 60%. And that is not easy. That is not easy to meet, especially if there's any organized opposition. I mean, the fact that it's even possible, the fact that it's still a realistic possibility that abortion rights clear 60% in Florida, just really captures the basic point that this is not a controversial position. These bans are extremely unpopular, right? And there's still a shot for abortion rights to get 60% for sure. There's also a measure in Florida to legalize weed in November, which is also an issue that has passed fairly easily around the country.
There are these ballot initiatives. There are these judgeship races. What's happening in this sort of in the Rust Belt, in the Michigan, Wisconsin area? Is there anything like that? Can you talk to us?
The stakes really, I think, in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, but also around the country, when it comes to state politics, is who is going to control, obviously, the state governments. So, you know, the state senates and state houses in almost every state are on the ballot every 2 years. So they will be again on the ballot in November. So, for instance, let's take the state of Michigan. The Democrats just won full control of Michigan for the first time since the 80s in 2022 in the midterms, we know, which was already a huge win for Democrats because it wasn't supposed to be a good year for them with the Democratic White House, and they gained full control of Michigan. And they've done actually a lot with that power. They've passed on an issue that I cover closely. They've passed a lot of voting rights bill to strengthen voting rights in Michigan, a lot of stuff that hadn't been able to pass for so long. And now the majorities that Democrats gained in 2022 are going to be up in 2024. Are Democrats going to be able to keep control of the state government in Michigan? You know, questions like that are primordial. In Wisconsin, Wisconsin is so important, Molly, because it's going to be the first election in so long for state Senate and state House that are not going to be under the gerrymanders because the state Supreme Court to connect all the dots of what we're talking about. When liberals gained the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin last year, they promptly struck down the gerrymandered maps that had locked in the GOP into power in Wisconsin for a long time. And this is going to be the first election in Wisconsin that is going to follow that is going to have fairer maps. So are Democrats going to be able potentially to take back the state Senate or the state House? At the very least, they should be able to make large gains in both chambers, which is going to also change the state a lot. That's, you know, we're seeing that kind of dynamic everywhere. I mean, a last example, in North Carolina, it's sort of an inverse situation. It's such an important state. It's a large state. So there's two things to watch there, I think. One is the Republican nominee for governor, you know, is as fortunate, right, as you get at this level of politics. He had made comments about whether women should have the right to vote.
He is the lieutenant governor, right?
He is right now the lieutenant governor, correct? And he's running against the AG, Josh Stein, who's a Democrat. So that's one, right? That's who's going to occupy the governor's mansion. The second is the state house and state senate. Why? Because the state Supreme Court actually flipped the GOP last year and blessed GOP gerrymanders, and Republicans have passed new maps as well in North Carolina for Congress. Republicans are hoping to keep super majorities that they have in North Carolina. Again, huge, huge impact on all sorts of issues, including abortion, because Republicans just passed major restrictions on abortion in North Carolina over the veto of the current governor. It's so important to keep an eye on governor's races and state house, state senate races all over the country with all of these states to watch.
So really interesting stuff. So the judgeships, the state houses, the state senates, is there any other state where we should be thinking about that's important? Besides, all the states are important, but where there's like small races that nobody is paying attention to?
What I will throw on the radar of people is, you know, I think earlier you said that I gave you an anxiety attack. So I'm gonna lean back in that direction.
No, that's okay. It's me. It's not you.
Law enforcement offices, Molly, we don't necessarily think of them as like the center of all of these important left-right struggles, but the Trump camp and the far right in general has found a lot of support among sheriff's offices around the country. There's a lot of far right connections, conferences even, that these officials attend, and they also are on the ballot. So in states like Arizona, again, in states like Kansas, in states like Wisconsin, you know, we are watching there these elections at the county level for sheriff and whether some people who are affiliated with these far-right groups are going to win re-election this year. You know, there's been more attention in recent years, I think, on the left among Democrats around these offices, around sheriffs. And we have seen some very high profile people on the far right lose, but we also have seen a lot more attention, I think, on the right to connect the dots between these sheriffs and invite them to conferences and talk to them about investigating elections and investigating abortion. Right. So we're also seeing a lot of that.
Pretty scary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Hi, John Fast. You know, Republicans have a long history of some dubious things with dogs coming up into presidential races, but this one is pretty disgusting this time. I think it tops them all.
Christy Noem makes Mitt Romney look like James Harriet.
Oh, boy.
She wrote a memoir. She probably didn't actually write it. Someone wrote a memoir for her, which included a story of her killing both a dog and a goat. She included these stories because she's a moron and because she forgot that there's one thing the American people love. It's dogs and also goats.
And then when she decided to make her statement on it, she admitted to killing three horses.
Oh, yeah. She is our moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.